This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. Tonight's guest is a gentleman that has been working to make a difference in our in this country of ours, Professor Ward Churchill. I have a feeling he's ruffled a lot more feathers than he may have intended to, or maybe that's exactly what he intended to do. Hello, Professor Churchill. It's a pleasure having you with us again.
It's a pleasure being here.
Can you fill us in on what's been happening since you've lost your position at the university?
Well, there's several fronts that could be addressed on that, most directly relevant to what you mentioned there. That game's not over yet. We're going to Colorado Supreme Court. Brief filing occurs on, ironically enough, I think, September 11th.
Wow. That is ironic.
Yeah. They set the date. I didn't.
Do you think that they did that on purpose?
I really doubt it. It was some clerk at the, or maybe not even a clerk, some bureaucrat having to do with the Colorado Supreme Court. When they set the extension time, they just took the next date in the progression. I don't think it had any particular significance, but one never knows. Perhaps it does.
Professor, you're following through with all of this right now. What do you expect to happen from this?
What do I expect to happen? Mm-hmm. Well, one has frail optimism, I suppose, that at some point there will be a judicial body in the state of Colorado that will actually pay attention to the law, rather than to political expediency or grinding their particular axes and biases. We'll see. The next stop after the Colorado Supreme Court, of course, would be the U.S. Supreme Court, whether they would accept the case, accept cert, as it's called. That's a crapshoot. It always is. The odds are fairly good, given the position that the state courts have taken, that their administrative regulations trump the Civil Rights Act, Section 1983 thereof, which is the basis of the lawsuit that I filed and won in court at trial. Jury unanimously concluded that there was a First Amendment violation, unlawful hiring, firing, and all the rest of it. It's been by judicial decree that that's been set aside. There actually has been some action on the part of at least the state level AAUP, American Association of University Professors, finally got off the dime with regard to investigating the nature of the process, which was used to serve as a cover on the firing. And I understand that's to be done fairly soon.
Good.
The sort of fact-checking that has occurred, they've called me up to confirm various facts and so forth. So my reading of that is favorable. I don't know how it will turn out, how concrete it will be, but that's good. Meanwhile, I'm back to writing, speaking, doing what I've always done. Actually, I never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, continuity there.
May I ask you, soon after 9/11, did you write the speech that has caused so much controversy in your life?
Well, it wasn't a speech. It was more in the order of a fairly extended, say, 10-page op-ed. And that was written on 9/11.
The
9/11. Okay, so I think it was posted on 9/12. So it was pretty much an off-the-top, from-the-gut take. on the significance of what it was that had just happened.
So, well, I think, but you offended a lot of people by some of your references, references to Carl Adolf Eichmann, and...
I may have offended Eichmann's relatives for all I know.
You may have, if he has any left. Can you tell us why you chose Eichmann, and explain the comparison to our listeners as to why you think it caused such a stir?
Why did it cause such a stir? Well, we could start there and then back into it.
Okay.
Why it causes such a stir is it did not automatically pronounce anyone and everyone, whoever they might happen to be, that was on the scene and was a casualty as a result, ipso facto innocent because they were Americans. Americans are not, by definition, innocent. American is not a synonym for innocent. Americans, there's a lot of things that are a little other than innocent in the world. And everyone acknowledges that, but comes a moment when there's any consequence to it, then all of a sudden the same rules of equity that would apply in any other context are suddenly suspended. And I don't know whether you will recall this, but on the morning of 9/11, I mean, I observed most of this in real time.
Mm-hmm.
All three major cable news outlets were pronouncing everyone who might be at issue, not only in the World Trade Center, but in the Pentagon, innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about 15,000 to 17,000 people. They had no idea, in other words, who was in the World Trade Center. As it turned out, the figures were much, much lower than that. But on a normal day, you could have had as many as 15,000 to 17,000 people in there.
And I do recall
automatically
those figures
innocent
being
of any
quoted.
Kind of wrongdoing. No one knew who had carried out the attack, much less why, what their motive might have been in carrying it out. But automatically, they had no motive. It was a senseless act, and everyone who was on the receiving end was automatically innocent. Well, I took some exception to that on its face, but that estimate that there might be 15,000 people tells you how wildly all-encompassing those terms of definition were. And I wanted to remind people that Americans do things in the world which could stimulate response in kind. And I want to put emphasis on in kind. Doing the same thing here that the United States does as a matter of course takes it as some sort of an entitlement to do to people elsewhere.
Professor Churchill, we often hear people say things like, war is hell. However, if someone like yourself says war is hell and then says because, and then goes on to speak more deeply on the subject, you're called and considered an anti-American. Why do you think such a...
if that's what America means, if that's what's going to embrace as its self-concept, definition of self, then I suppose I would be an anti-American. I just see other possibilities out there. But I don't think I ever really addressed your question about why Eichmann.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. No, you didn't.
Yeah, and
just
the,
you said
the
that, and it
is,
just triggered that thought in me. It's like, I apologize. Go right ahead.
It was sort of long, drawn-out answer that I was giving there. But Eichmann basically is emblematic of the so-called desk murderer. In other words, Adolf Eichmann, the Adolf Eichmann, not the little Eichmanns, not the figurative Eichmanns,
mm-hmm.
we use for purposes of rhetorical comparison. The real man was instrumental in the Holocaust and yet never killed anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think even the Israelis, there was one accusation, or better put, there was a single accusation of the killing of the one person, Jewish person. and that was dropped in the trial. So essentially, he was not even accused of that. Basically, he was a logistician, a bureaucrat, not particularly high-ranking one either. He was a lieutenant colonel, held that rank, the equivalent of that rank in the administrative SS. He arranged train schedules. He arranged the shipping of the gas. They arranged the shipment of the gold from the teeth. And basically, all of the logistical enterprise, he arranged for the shipment of people. So the musters and all of that. Technical stuff. Never killed anyone. Never got his hands dirty. In fact, he did not even issue the orders for the killings to occur. And he was convicted of Class A, crimes against humanity, for his role. Because absent his application of his technical expertise, his proficiency, and all the rest of that, not necessarily even for ideological reasons, although he may have been more ideologically motivated than historically people have thought he was, irrespective of that, he did it for narrow self-interest, the purposes of career advancement, petty prestige, and so forth, because that was his job and to excel at it. Mm. And the result, what it was he was producing through this application, one, two, three steps removed of his particular expertise, was the piles of bodies that we've all seen in a newsreel footage about the Holocaust. He was producing carnage, ultimately, or at least allowing or making the carnage occur in a much more efficient manner, much more extravagantly expensive for those in receiving in manner than it would otherwise have been the case. Now, if you look at the cost and consequence of profit maximization on part of U.S. corporations, so it's just not because they're better or worse than others that we can name, but let's say Adidas, the manufacturing of footwear in sweatshops in Marianas Island, or the Marshalls, or in Malaysia, where Nike could fit into this as well. Okay, essentially it's 12-year-old children compulsorily at labor, 12 hours a day, immiserated, emaciated. Carnage of another sort. Carnage of a very related sort, however. And that's the name of the game. You trade stock based upon profitability and full knowledge that it's the sweatshops, mass immiseration of brown-skinned children, and so on. You do it for your commission. You do it for your personal advancement. If you starve children for a living, in other words, you're the moral equivalent of Eichmann. That's the conclusion I drew. Little Eichmanns, perhaps, but Eichmanns nonetheless. And Eichmann here is no different qualitatively than Eichmann there. And if you want people not to respond in the way response occurred on September 11th, maybe you ought to stop starving their babies. Maybe you should stop killing their babies, and then maybe they won't want to kill you. If you take it as an entitlement because you're some sort of a superior breed of humanity, call it the master race, call it American citizen, call it whatever you want to call it. If you presume a superior station which entitles you to turn other people in essentially to toilet paper, well, there's a cost and consequence to that. When you push people, eventually somebody's going to push back. And they're going to push back the best way they can, but it's going to be in kind. Essentially, you could look at 9/11 as them saying, see how you like it, and if you don't like it, stop. But the stopping hasn't occurred.
No, unfortunately, it hasn't occurred. One of the things that, if I were to look at this scenario and look at the people and who actually were in the towers at that infamous moment, they were perhaps little Eichmanns or part of a larger Eichmann. To me,
well,
that
the
makes
enterprise, the criminal enterprise, as it was called, as regards to the real Eichmann, the SS was designated a criminal organization because of its the purpose served by its functioning, its very existence. And you could make the same case here. You could certainly make the case that those in the buildings condoned the process which produced these results, which was exactly the crime assigned to the German people. I don't hear too many people being concerned about how many supposed innocent bystanders were killed by the 8th Air Force in a process of reducing the German in military capacity, industrial capacity to, well, they intended to reduce it to zero.
Would it matter, Professor, after Vietnam, America has decided not to count enemy dead? So I don't think we really care, do we, how many died?
It doesn't make them more alive. It just means that
just makes them uncounted. It's a hugely...
Well, and there's the low counting of in Vietnam. Yeah, they reported enemy dead. They did body count. They did all of these things. But ultimately, Gunter Louis and other deniers, and that's what I'll call them, essentially lowballed the figures to come out with a million or less dead people. Robert McNamara put it at 3 million. The Vietnamese put it at around 5. But the total focus for mourning in this country has to do with about, well, fewer than 60,000 U.S. names inscribed in black granite in Washington, D.C. Excuse me, that's not the price paid. That's not those who died. That's a minuscule fraction of those who died. The bulk of the dying was done on the other side. And until we start to value them in some manner equivalent to our own. One brown-skinned child is just as valuable as one white-skinned child. One other nationality body is just as important, just as significant as a U.S. body. Until that starts to register, which it really hasn't, even in those who oppose the war, as near as I can tell.
I wrote an article once about the language describing our war, the occupation of war, and one of the things that I, you know, things like the arena of war, you know, this is not hockey. This is killing people and breaking things.
Hockey, you actually get some pain and human blood splattered around. Okay. This is more like video game we're talking about here, for all the attention that's paid to this. That's actual people, flesh and bone and blood and agony that's occurring there.
Do we call it free speech in America? Is it really free in America? If what you said you got fired for, how free is that?
No, and in fact, those, you know, who want to talk about the founding fathers and blah, 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 and I'm talking about teabaggers, essentially. We can work out a little more broadly than that, but let's just focus there. If I had a dollar, oh, make it $10 for every email I got during the spring of 2005 reminding me that free speech comes at a price, reminding me of the costs of free speech. Well, I'd probably buy the university and open an educational institution there. Okay? But that's really thundering duh in terms of the disconnect that's involved. If there's inherently a cost to exercising your right to free speech, then the speech isn't free.
Well, I've always said, Professor,
that's the fundamental proposition at work in this country. You can do it, but you will pay a price. And the price can be, which I didn't have to pay, and I'm not complaining about not having to pay it, but you can look to Eugene V. Debs being sentenced to 5 years at the time of World War One for voicing opposition to U.S. entry into World War One, or Kate Richards O'Hare would be another one. You have everything in that continuum to sorts of things that happen. with me. And I'm hardly alone. There's a number of other people that have had that experience. Well, at a certain level, I'm not complaining about it. Okay? I could even take it as a compliment.
Would it do any good to complain?
Well, I suppose I'm complaining by virtue of suing them, am I not?
I don't consider that. I think a complaint seems more to me as a passive reaction. I think you're taking an aggressive action by defending your freedom to speak. I don't see that as just a complaint.
My freedom to speak is something that I assume by virtue of doing it. If you don't exercise the right is useless anyway. So I'm not dependent upon this for my freedom to speak. I will simply do that. What is of more concern me is to disentitle those who would entitle themselves to visit the consequence. They're going to pay a price for it.
Mm.
Okay. And that doesn't affect whether or not I say A, B, or C, one way or the other. But if they're going to display the arrogance, the audacity, the sense of entitlement that it attends this elaborate contrivance to visit penalties on me for it, then I'm inclined to make them pay for it.
Mm.
So it's that way. It's combat they want, it's combat they got.
Well, Professor, I've always said that if they give you the power or the rights, then they can very well take those rights and the power from you.
Right. They give you no rights. Rights are inherent.
Exactly. So what happened that it became so convoluted?
Excuse me. I was coughing. I smoked
a lot
of cigarettes.
Well, I was saying, what happened in America that has created such confusion over what is an inherent right and what is a universal given right, or who can take our rights away? If it's an inherent right, how can they take it away from us?
They can't take them away from you. They can only violate them. You can, on the other hand, alienate your rights. You can give them up. I mean, if they're inherent to you, if they inherit in you, all right, you can divest yourself of the right. You can give it away. I haven't given mine away.
Good.
I always compare it essentially to a rape situation. We understand what rape is, and I understand also that there's definitional issues that have now been injected into that from a number of quarters, but basically everybody understands what rape is.
Mm-hmm.
But rape doesn't occur if you consent. Okay?
I see. So you can't
be
violated unless you consent to the violation.
Yeah. So that the right remains with a victim of a rape not to be raped. You're no less entitled not to be raped after a rape than you were before. The right inheres. In fact, you could say the same thing in the process of the violation itself. Even while you're being raped, you have every right not to be. That never, ever goes away unless you give it away. All rights basically function in that form. I use that because graphic illustration sometimes penetrates the fog. They want to tell me about rights or something
right to
in the form
education.
Of legal codes. It's not.
No, it isn't.
They can be enunciated there.
Mm-hmm.
You can have formal protections, acknowledgments of the rights, and protections of the rights enunciated in law, but the rights themselves do not arise from law.
I don't think anything of justice arises from our legislative body or our laws today. I believe that they are inherently criminal in and of themselves.
Well, yes, I would have to concur with that.
David Horowitz accused American students of believing critical thought means anti-Americanism. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm relatively sure there's probably somebody out there that meets that description, and David's famous for making postulations
for finding that
like
one
that.
Person.
Yeah, he'll find, he works off anecdote. He'll find one real or imagined case, and in some senses, if you believe what you're imagining to be true, then for you it's true. So he finds someone who believes that they've been violated in a specific way, and he extrapolates from that to make it some totalistic experience or condition of the academy or condition of some other entity. His focus has been on the academy for some period of time, but he has worked outside that paradigm in the course of his career. And I might also point out, on less grounds of expediency than he tends to, that he made exactly the opposite arguments in times past, purporting all the while to be something he wasn't then. David's career has been locating parades in a way and jumping in front of them to purport to be the leader of them. Okay? He's a unreconstructed Trotskyite, as near as I can tell. That was his grounding, although his, you know, for all the political theory he pumps out, for all the sociological analysis he pumps out, his degree is in literature. He worked with Isaac Deutscher. Deutscher was a pretty good writer, actually, and a few other Trotskyists. This is not a New Left circumstance, but according to David Horowitz, David Horowitz was one of the founders of the New Left. And he remained a founder of the New Left
now,
right up until the New Left started to go into decline.
Now that's a scary statement.
Yeah, well, that's radical
that
fun,
is a
you know.
Scary statement.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this.
Once that parade
this.
Started to dissipate, then he found another parade.
Right.
In front of that.
In its attack on what I believe the educational system of this country, it used to be a sought-after ideology of the educational system, liberal education. Now it's talked about like some kind of an infectious disease that somebody's going to catch. How are
yeah, there was a sort of a quid pro quo that was arrived at just before 1930 between the organization that I mentioned earlier, the AUP, on the one hand, and the reactionary, I don't know of a better word to use or term to use, the reactionaries who were in charge of the institutional circumstance. And that was that conservatives basically would set the agenda, although conservative is a poor word choice, actually, the reactionaries, let's just stick with that. They would set the agenda, but they would do it in a framing of liberal arts, but liberal doesn't mean radical. So the quid pro quo was the right would launch an attack, and the liberal left would validate the legitimacy of that attack in expunging radicals from the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that was actually formalized in those agreements in 1928.
I see.
AAUP and the American Association of University Presidents and the American Association of College Presidents, and there was a third organization. That was sort of a compact. Well, that's broken down, essentially, because for the same reason as the sorts of quid pro quo that you saw entered into in Congress until very recently, as it evaporated when you've got this really rabid fascistic and not really very bright right wing running amok.
No, not bright at all.
Higher educational
I'm starting to seriously have concern for the future of our nation.
Yeah, well, see, maybe part of the problem there, and there's reason for concern irrespective of how you frame this, okay, but I don't see in our nation anywhere out there.
No.
There's a status entity that purports to have the legitimacy vested in itself to essentially compel participation by virtue of physical incorporation of all 400 odd indigenous nations.
Mm.
Okay? And
absolutely.
I'm not disavowed the theory of internal colonialism, which was very explanatory 40 years ago. Well, the conditions haven't changed other than they've become more rigid and people have gotten more confused because there's process of indoctrination and obfuscation of functions in the name of an educational system here. But you've got even Euro-American society, you know. I think Appalachia would be an island of colonial enclave, if you will, composed primarily of white people at this point, but are treated in every other respect as colonial subjects. So you've got a multiplicity of nations encompassed within this overarching state, and I don't mean state in the sense that the state of Arizona is a state, should be called a province. The state. Centralized government ruling on the basis of arbitrary code of regulations that are enforced basically at gunpoint. There are a lot more to it. That's a simplistic definition. They will always try to convince people that their greater interest is not only going along but embracing the damn thing. So you have sort of perpetual psy war. You got the media bombardment, you got propaganda and so forth that figure into that. There are a lot of avenues, but essentially the bottom line is they'll kill you if you really get serious about announcing you're not part of this whole process. So our nation, that framing, essentially validates a falsehood that they want to perpetuate in order to maintain them. Themselves in the station to which they would like to believe themselves entitled. Or at least
well, in this entity that we call America, and I do understand completely where you're coming from on this, my concern is that we've been reduced to polar rhetoric. You're either liberal or you're conservative. Unfortunately, where does that leave us on issues?
Well, for one thing, you can refuse that, too. Okay, I'm neither. I suppose my credentials would be more impeccably conservative than most of the people who are running around calling themselves conservative. I've actually paid attention to the Constitution, and I don't think the Founding Fathers ended slavery. A few things like that. You know, the level of knowledge of those who wrap themselves in a flag is abysmally low. That's not an especially conservative characteristic. I've actually met thoughtful conservatives that have met awfully stupid, knee-jerk liberals, too. Okay?
And I've met
fashion statement radicals as well. So it's not something that's easily defined. But, you know, if you've got to have labels for things, of which most people out there have to have some sort of label assigned before they can start to think they think about something. I would call myself an indigenous, taking first people as first priority. By first peoples, I mean the indigenous nations whose land this is and always was and who have been subsumed. And that's my first point. But in terms of a political doctrine ensuing from that, it doesn't readily translate across cultures from what indigenous peoples tended to practice, and there's lots of variations, as many variations as there are peoples, and there's even variations within the peoples, and that starts to get to something. And that is probably the closest approximation you could find in the Western tradition would be anarchism. But I mean anarchism in a true sense of the term, not as a fashion statement.
Well, I have to tell you, I never would have considered myself a conservative, but I have to agree with you. I'm very conservative on some of the statements. If, in fact, the truth and the understanding of issues such as the Constitution are what we're looking for in our conservative stance. You know, it was almost, but I had fallen a victim of those same kinds of labels. But as you spoke, you talk about being an indigenous, and here, and I'd like to take you back to a statement you made in Hawaii. You said in response to a journalist, that they would never ask President George W. Bush if he was white. Why ask you if you were an Indian? And it would only be a question asked of an American Indian. I have people ask me, what is a Palestinian? I'm a Palestinian. Okay. How does one respond to that?
Well, actually, there is a lot of overlap on identity issues and other issues as well in that regard. My older brother, Russell Means, put this the best I've ever heard it put at a press conference in 1982, and that was during the Israeli assault on Beirut. Mm-hmm. PLO fighters were mostly trapped in Beirut. There were others elsewhere, but you had this concentration in Beirut, and Arafat was there. And the Israelis themselves were looking for some place that would accept Arafat because their political calculus was it would be a catastrophe to kill a guy or capture him. Then what are they going to do with him? Okay, big problem. But nobody was taking them up on it. Finally, it was Tunisia. But in the middle of that, we had an occupation going at the time about 13 miles outside of Rapid City, South Dakota, 880-acre tract called Yellow Thunder Camp, Yellow Thunder Yoshpai. And Russ called a press conference and said that the Palestinians of North America offer sanctuary to the American Indians of the Middle East. Yasser Arafat will be welcome in Yellow Thunder Camp.
I never heard that before.
That's exactly what it is.
I'm surprised Russell didn't say that. I've interviewed him on my show. I've never heard that before from him. I love that.
Yeah, that framed it perfectly as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is cool. Professor, may I ask you, is it the message or is it the delivery that you think that people have issue with?
Oh, probably both.
Mm-hmm.
To which I say, good. If they have an issue with it, then they paid some kind of attention to it.
True.
And I learned that a long time ago. You got to slap them hard to get any kind of attention at all. You nice and reasonable and present all the correct arguments and burn your little candle and walk into the free speech pen that they've assigned you and all the rest of these state-sanctioned things. Everyone yawns. You can bring a million people out. They did in opposition to the Gulf War. You can put a million people on the street. So what? All right? Who compelled attention was Aim at Wounded Knee, the American Indian Movement.
Mm-hmm.
Going in, withstanding a siege at Wounded Knee for 71 days, armed confrontation. Not too many people got killed out of that, fortunately enough, but people did get killed. You got two dead Indians out of it. You got a paralyzed U.S. Marshal who was probably shot by his own guys, but nonetheless, when you got that much firepower deployed.
Going on, you can't really tell in the end.
Black Panthers made a whole lot of, I'll use the word, more liberal black politicos far more credible than they would otherwise have been as an alternative to the Black Panther. But in the process, people started paying attention to the issues that were being raised, trying to understand what was going on. This is not a country that will stop watching professional sports and talking heads on TV who never mention the sorts of things I'm talking about unless it's to score points against some opposition. You can get these two guys from the new Black Panther Party who became iconic because they run continuously on Fox News. But with no discourse, no analysis worthy of the name ever as to why they were there at the polling place that day, someplace in Ohio, I think. All right. You got to sort of, well, let me quote another guy who was pretty good with sound bites and capsule descriptions. Capsule's not a pun. You'll understand why I say this in a moment. Abby Hoffman once explained that as he saw it, you know, everybody in the country had a plastic bubble over their head and reality was being projected on the inside of it. And so long as the bubble was in place, whatever was projected was reality as far as they were concerned. And his job was to kick a hole in the plastic bubble and let a little light in of an alternative reality.
Wow.
So these things are calculated. I actually feel the way I speak and write. These things are always anchored in my gut and in experience. I did not, of course, experience the French and Indian Wars, for example, but I experienced Vietnam, and I see Vietnam in exactly the terms those in charge were framing it as another Indian War. In fact, it was called Indian Country when you went out in outside the barbed wire. You go outside a U.S. basing area, you were in Indian Country. And, of course, it was fought the same way. Technological variations, of course, in the 19th century, they did not have the aerial firepower that was deployed in Vietnam. But on the ground, people were taking scalps into ears. And yet, just gratuitous wholesale killing.
Very scary stuff. May I
Deadly
ask?
Stuff. You can extrapolate experientially. I'll never really know the French and Indian Wars or the Dutch and what they did before New York was New York. It was still New Amsterdam, what they did to the Wappingers. But I got enough direct sense of that. But, I'll just go back to what I said to begin with. I actually feel the way I write. And I speak the way I speak because that's how I feel about it.
That's a beautiful, I believe that's a beautiful message in and of itself. We have a question from George in Iowa for you. He asks, when suing the government agency assigned responsibility for any issue, why is it that if you beat them in court, it seems there is always another department within the government that makes the decision?
Well, I'm not sure that's applicable in this case. Okay? They didn't say another department made the decision in this case. They said that, okay, you won. They violated your rights. But a judge said after the fact, they're quasi-judicially immune from penalty. So even though it's confirmed in a court of law that your rights were violated and they did the violating exactly the way you said they did, and it was a wrongful firing, so what?
But it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
I was trying to figure out what that meant exactly, and I think they're telling you it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, you got all these rights, but if they're violated, oh well. And you see that more and more and more, this doctrine of quasi-judicial immunity. I mean, judicial immunity has always applied. Judges are immune. Judges can mess over your rights, and that can be found. You have some sort of redress insofar as sentences they pass on you and so forth can be reversed on that basis. But the judge himself in the court system cannot be held liable for what was done in the court. Quasi-judicial immunity means exactly the same thing, but you're just not a judge.
All right? See.
And you see that being extended more and more and more broadly. Now, what that means is the government, and that's the entity that is most constrained by constitutional guarantees of rights to citizens and so forth. Okay? They can be extended to corporate entities and other non-governmental entities in certain situations, but those guarantees, constraints, apply to the government first and foremost. That's what they were designed to do. And the government is in the process of exempting itself from any kind of penalty for violating. So it's a different kind of subterfuge. A subterfuge, nonetheless, and that's what really I think George in Iowa was raising, was the fact, you know, play this little shell game with regard
to
responsibility, who individually or which entity is specifically responsible for a violation. Then they play these games of passing the buck around in a circle. That's one way. But I'm talking about something that's actually, in a way, much more sweeping. Because they don't even have to bother passing it around. They can just acknowledge straight up, yeah, guilty as charged. And so?
May I ask you, what is going on in the indigenous community in relationship to the economy? I mean, being as devastated as our economy has become over the last few years, I can only imagine that reservation life must have been impacted unfathomably. Except that.
Reservation life has always been marked by such monumental degree of destitution and day-to-day misery, they're ratcheting up a little bit or down a little bit really doesn't have the kind of effect that you might imagine.
I suppose you're right on that.
I mean, if you're hopeless, how do you take
hope away? Where do you go from there?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, that's not a universal situation. It's still emblematic of the overall context. Some reservations do better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a certain irony embodied in some of this, because mm-hmm. some of the gaming reservations, insofar as there's not been off-reservation competitors established, mm-hmm. and in a lot of contexts there have been over the last couple decades, but where there's really kind of an Indian monopoly on gaming in a given area, you probably see an improvement because the despair is more generalized. The destitution, the hopelessness may not be as long-standing and firmly established as it is on the reservation, but non-Indian communities are feeling that. And one of the things that you see happen, I mean, aside from OxyContin becoming ever more popular and, you know, other forms of substance abuse and alcohol,
mm-hmm.
is people are going down and buying more and more of those goddamn lottery tickets, you know.
Yeah.
Hoping against hope. It's when you're hopeless, you know, you get these little beacons. Well, you got a casino here. You can play slot machines. And you can play blackjack if you're inclined to do it. You can do all of these things. Which is
Professor,
really a major desperation, but increases revenues for the gaming tribes. So,
right. As a matter of fact, my husband, we own some property up north. I think we own some property. I'm not sure that you would see it as that. there are a lot of casino areas there. And as we were driving by one of the newer casinos that had opened, Turtle Creek, my husband looked and he said to me, I'll be damned if the Native American Indians are going to win back their country through gambling.
There you have it.
And I said, wow, you no truer words were ever said.
Yeah, there's some sort of deliciousness. The comedian Charlie Hill, he's an Oneida stand-up comic, used to talk about payback with the Catholic Church, you know. Got even with the Catholic Church by stealing its central sacred ceremony, bingo. Little things like that. You can come up with this kind of humor off it, but, you know, a more cogent or even pungent observation was Vine Deloria's, that you do not reestablish a national economy on the basis of bingo. And that's really what we're talking about with the casino. You know, Monaco, I suppose, runs on the basis of the casinos and has for a long time. But generally speaking, it doesn't resolve the issue.
No, it doesn't. And
you shouldn't have to buy back property that was stolen from you in the first place. Everybody seems to think that's a real reasonable thing. Well, the Indians generate money. They can buy some property and, you know, they can petition the federal government to place it in trust, in federal trust for them. That's worked out real well. You may have noticed in the Cobell case, about $150 billion, it was estimated, that had been misappropriated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs out of those trust accounts. And those monies were, in fact, used for this vaunted quality of life for non-Indians that they take as an entitlement. And then they settle the case when they're caught on it. After stonewalling it for 15 years, they arrive at a $3.5 billion settlement. And you got a whole bunch of people out there who are just outraged that the Indians are getting that after swallowing $150 billion of assets, liquid and otherwise, from the most destitute people on the continent. Something really to be proud of.
Can I so you're back to speaking. Where are you going to be? Anybody, any place where some of our listeners may be able to catch some of your words?
I'm pretty much done speaking for this cycle. I've got a new grandbaby, and I'm playing with her this summer.
Okay. Oh, congratulations. That's wonderful. You know, somehow we forget that we that some of our guests and some of these incredible people actually have lives, actually have families, actually have things that they would much rather be doing, but instead they're defending our rights. I appreciate that from one grandparent to another.
There you have it. I mean, you're doing the same thing by virtue of running the program, so let me express appreciation to you. You know, we can have a mutual admiration society going
hey,
here right
on air.
That
works for me. I'm good with it.
But, no, let's see. As far as I can think ahead, off the top of my head, San Antonio, Texas, in, I can't even come up with a date. I'm doing San Antonio. I'm doing a thing in New York. I'm doing a thing in Atlanta. Way up north of Yellowknife. Those things
very
I know
good.
Of.
Very good. Now, of course, you do have a website where they can catch your speaking series and things like that.
It's wardchurchillsupport.net. And I don't run it. Other people do. But that's the place I tend to refer people to if they want to know what's upcoming.
Before we leave for the evening, Professor, I'd like to ask you a very simple question. Briefly, your thoughts on President Obama.
Oh, my goodness.
Remember, we've only got a couple minutes left, so go for it.
It's real simple. You know, my thought on that is, I told you so. Mm. Although I didn't tell you, and I probably didn't tell your listeners, and I wasn't really much inclined to do it, but I told a fair number of my old comrades who were, and I mean comrades in the sense that I have a history that includes a bunch of people who were party people, who were VVAW people, SDS people, and so forth, who were all enthralled with him. And several, in fact, actually asked me to participate in organizing. Why, I don't know. It seemed to me that would be the kiss of death for him. I mean, he already had Bill Ayers that he was settled with. He didn't need to be settled with me. So maybe it was an act of charity that I didn't. But, you know, I said, if you you'll like this, I suppose, if you can get some kind of referendum where the Palestinians will tell me that that's what I ought to do, given his position on Israel, then I'll take it under advisement. And universally, when I brought that up, they sort of deflated and went, oh, yeah, that sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah, it really did.
Ask me a Palestinian.
It was right there for anybody who wanted to look all along, you know?
You know, I find it interesting. We are so quick to always say here in America that we help people all over the world. And I'm thinking to myself, well, the Palestinians have been asking for America's help for about, 63 years now? I don't know which people.
You know, if you use them people in terms individuals,
yeah,
U.S. probably helps some. Okay, but peoples as peoples that have been helped by the United States, that'd be a really short list.
Very short list, unfortunately. Well, Professor, it has been a distinct pleasure having you and an honor, sir. Keep up the good work. Say it like it is. And it's amazing that people are seeing you as the enemy. That's something we really have to look at in this country. Next Tuesday, Laura Wells, California candidate for governor, has the solution for America. State-run banks on June 26th at the People Speak radio show. Thank you very much, everyone. Ward Churchill, we appreciate you being with us tonight. Keep up the good work. We'll be keeping tabs on you. And good. And I hope to have you back with us again one day, Ward.
Give me a call.
Will do. Good night, everyone. And remember, when the people speak, we make a difference.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry. And I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island.